This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Douglas Impoga in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Media and civil society are effectively silenced. Does not create a good environment for free and fair elections.
That's Human Rights Watch Africa researcher Oriem Nyeko calling on the Tanzanian government to open up the political space so that the country can conduct upcoming elections. Also, Algeria's judges and prosecutors have gone on strike, potentially affecting December elections. Rwanda still has 50,000 cases seeking reimbursement for property burned or stolen during the genocide. And John Conyers, who championed civil rights issues while serving in the U.S. House of Representatives for more than 50 years, has died. We'll have these stories and more, so stay with us. There's a lot more ahead on Africa News Tonight. A new report from two prominent human rights groups says the Tanzanian government is abusing the rights of journalists and opposition parties. The report released today shows the East African nation has adopted repressive laws that restrict the activities of the media, non-government organizations, and opposition groups. For VOA, Mohamed Yusuf reports.
In a joint press conference in Nairobi, representatives of Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch said Tanzania's government, led by President John Magufuli, has oppressed voices critical to his administration since taking power in 2015. Amnesty International Tanzania's researcher Roland Ebole said they spoke to 68 people for the report and found reams of documentary evidence to back up the accusations.
We got charge sheets in cases of those who had been arrested or presented or charged by the police. We obtained court judgments, court decisions or court documents by those who were arraigned in court. We obtained photographic and video evidence by those who alleged different forms of violations.
President Magufuli came to power in November 2015 with a promise to fight corruption. He was known for shutting down companies and firing government workers without due process. Once in office, he moved to shut down anyone who challenged his authority. In 2016, legislators approved a Magufuli-backed law that gives security agencies the power to search media organizations, seize their equipment, and close them without a court order. In 2017, the government closed down two newspapers it accused of inciting violence and has since revoked licenses of three more media organizations. Muthoki Mumo of the Committee to Protect Journalists says the government cannot root out corruption while oppressing journalists, who are often the ones who report on officials' misdeeds.
He came to power with an aggressive anti-corruption agenda. But the question that comes up again and again when we do this research is, how do you expect to implement this? Or how do you expect to achieve these goals if there's no free press?
Mumo was also arrested in Tanzania in 2018. According to the rights groups, the government has also banned the gatherings of opposition politicians and prosecuted some politicians on fabricated charges. Human Rights Watch Africa researcher Oriem Nyeko calls on the Tanzanian government to open up the political space so that the country can conduct upcoming elections.
The findings that we have, that media and civil society are effectively silenced, does not create a good environment for free and fair elections. So we are encouraging and urging the government to ease these restrictions on civil society and the media, to amend the restrictive laws.
VOA contacted a Tanzanian government spokesman for comment on this story, but calls went unanswered. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Algeria's long and painful election process has taken another hit, with judges and prosecutors going on strike, bringing the court system to a halt. Magistrates play a major role in overseeing elections in the North African country, which is scheduled to go to the polls on December 12th to choose a new president to replace Abdelaziz Bouteflika. He quit in April amid mass protests over the announcement he would seek a fifth term. The judges are demanding independence after the Justice Ministry reshuffled the judiciary, a move that affected half of the 6,000 judges and prosecutors. The elections already have been postponed once. 22 candidates have been registered to replace Bouteflika, including two former ministers who served under him. The protests continue with demands for an infusion of new blood into the political elite. Years after the Rwanda genocide, the country is not only still trying to track down some of the perpetrators, but is also struggling to implement court decisions for survivors seeking reimbursement for damaged or stolen property. The Rwanda National Commission for Unity says this impedes reconciliation programs. Eugene Uimana has more details from Kigali.
The Ministry of Justice says more than 50,000 court decisions are yet to be implemented to render justice for genocide survivors whose properties were tortured during Rwanda's genocide. Fide Ndayisaba is the executive secretary of the National Commission for Unity and Reconciliation. He calls the problem the breaks in the reconciliation journey. When you look at obstacles in our reconciliation journey, the problem of unpaid, damaged or stolen properties comes at the front of it. That's why we're urging responsible stakeholders to solve this problem quickly. To delay means to keep hatred amongst Rwandans. The perpetrators are growing old now. If you wait to shift claims to their children, the burden will grow bigger. Dusingize Mungu Jean-Pierre is the president of Ibuka, an umbrella organization of genocide survivors. He claims bailiffs and some other institutions have been very negligent. We don't understand why this problem has not been totally solved. I hope this is due to the lack of will of local leaders who don't want to finish the matter. Rules and regulations on how to implement are clear, but arriving down in the local administration, they hit a deadlock. The problem is being scrutinized by the Elders Advisory Council, which we advise the government on the best ways to close the book on the genocide's transgenerational consequences. Mukana Bana Maria is the council's vice chairperson. She says the advice we'll be giving is of setting up plans to finish these cases very urgently. There are many ways, including that of going down in villages and bringing together survivors and perpetrators to talk about solutions. The government needs to highlight this problem as an emergency, but the Minister of Justice says it's not easy, as some perpetrators have died or fled the country, leaving no property behind, while others are very poor. There are no accurate figures detailing the genocide's economic impact, but the World Bank estimates the tragedy caused a 58% decrease in GDP in 1994. More than 1 million lives were taken in just 100 days. Eugene Uimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
Former U.S. Congressman John Conyers, who championed civil rights issues while serving in the U.S. House of Representatives for more than 50 years, died yesterday at the age of 90. Conyers was first elected in 1964, representing Detroit. He was a founding member of the Congressional Black Caucus, and he introduced legislation to create a holiday honoring Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. just days after the civil rights icon's assassination in 1968. His efforts finally succeeded in 1983 when President Ronald Reagan signed the bill into law. Conyers also called for federal spending to study the issue of compensating African-American descendants of slaves. The executive director of the UN's World Food Programme has just left Sudan. David Beasley flew into South Kordofan last week to assess humanitarian needs, the first time that has happened in more than 8 years. Bisley says it all came about after he recently sat down with the leaders of Sudan and South Sudan and got their commitments to allow humanitarian workers unfettered access to the region, something he calls quite extraordinary. Earlier, he spoke with my colleague, Carol Van Dam.
What we've been able to see has been quite remarkable. We've seen people coming together, political enemies coming together, that was just quite extraordinary, from Sudan government as well as South Sudan government, to allow us access in areas that have been denied for literally 8 years. And so two clear examples, just in the past few days, we shipped the first barge from what is called Kusti in Sudan down to South Sudan into another area called Rinke, which this barge has not been able to operate down this river for 8 years. And this saves us an extraordinary amount of money and allows us to access people that we've not been able to access. And the second area is what we call Kauda in the Nuba Mountain area. And this area has not been accessed for over 8 years. And amazing that the parties came together literally to allow us this access, which is just an extraordinary cooperation.
Now, this is in part due to the new government in Sudan, the Sovereign Council, of course, right?
Well, it is. And I know there was a lot of reservations and hesitancy by some of the leaders, for example, Abdulaziz in the Kauda area, the SPLN. And they expressed concern that, well, okay, maybe this is just more rhetoric and they don't mean it in terms of access. But I sat down with the Prime Minister of Sudan, Hamdok, as well as Burhan and Hamedi, whom you well know are very powerful leaders inside Sudan. And I sat down with each one of these leaders individually for several hours in discussing why this is important, why this is a signal to the world that it is a new dawn and a new day.
But how did you get beyond their mistrust of one another?
Well, I don't want to say it wasn't easy, but it was quite frankly a little bit surprising. That it was like a new spirit of these leaders of truly wanting to showcase a reality that it is a new dawn, a new day. Because Hamdok had told me when I met with him at the UNGA in New York, and had extensive conversation, that he wanted to prove that his desire to open up humanitarian access anywhere we wanted to go in Sudan was real. And I said, well, I'm going to put you to the test. I'm going to come to Sudan literally within a month or two. And so when we sat down and had the discussions, then, of course, you know, it's just not just one leader. Several leaders that are critical, from the military to the intelligence, as well as to the government in general from Sudan. And then, of course, getting the permission and the cooperation from Abdulaziz and the leaders from this particular region, the Nuba Mountains, and you know that conflict and how bad that's been.
Right.
And I had a long, extensive conversation with Abdulaziz, as well as Salva Kiir, as well as Machar, explaining how critical this was. We must show cooperation for all the people. It's time. It's a new day. And I believe.
And they all agreed with you. In the end, they agreed with you.
They sure did. And quite frankly, there were I would say, bureaucrats down below that fought it. But the leaders, and I told them, I said, look, you have to understand, we will hold you accountable for the impediments down below you. I said, you've got to prove this by truly changing the system all the way down to the ground, the grassroots level. And they did. They made it happen. They worked together. And now it's not the end of the story. We got a lot more work to do, but this is one extraordinary beginning of what appears to be a new day, a new dawn.
Now, I want to talk to you a little about, since you did get in there, in Kauda and some other places, what you saw there. Can you give me a little glimpse of what you saw?
Well, yeah. In fact, when we helicoptered in terms of Kauda and got to a location that's obviously, you know, as you know, has not had the United Nations access for over 8 years, and I was really surprised in three ways. One was the spirit. The spirit of the people on the ground was remarkable. You could sense that they're excited. They couldn't believe that this was happening. They could not believe that I was there from the United Nations and our team. And so you could see this excitement that maybe this is the beginning of a new day. The second thing was I was really taken back at how resilient the people have been in terms of of food security and how health. I don't want to say they were all healthy. That's not the issue. But they were better than I was anticipating.
How were they getting by? Did they talk to you?
Well, they've been trying to make it on their own in a difficult circumstances, which leads me to the third point, and that is there are some serious humanitarian needs. There's some food needs. There's health care needs, and there's definitely educational needs. And I think we can work with these leaders and the people in this community. They don't want handouts. This is what's really quite remarkable. They don't want handouts. They want us to help them so they become self-sufficient. And you can see it in their spirit.
That was WFP Executive Director David Beasley speaking to my colleague Caro Van Dam after arriving back in Rome from Kaouda in Sudan's Nuba Mountains. African Americans are being encouraged to visit Ghana to mark 400 years since the beginning of the transatlantic slave trade. In the capital Accra, one returnee chef is awaiting U.S. visitors to give them a taste of home in the homeland. Stacey Knott reports for VOA from Accra.
At her roadside cafe in Accra, Chef Sage cooks up food influenced by her time in the United States, the Caribbean, and Ghana. Spices from her lentil burgers waft into the air as members of her loyal customer base take their seats at the outdoor tables.
You know, I had that Southern influence, my grandmother with cornbread and macaroni and cheese, and, you know, the whole soul food works. And then also being in the Caribbean, having that Caribbean influence as well. And I don't know if a lot of people residing in Africa know that the foods in the Caribbean are so similar. You have direct descendants coming from Africa to the Caribbean.
Chef Sage, she prefers not to use her real name, says she is seeing more African-American customers who are in Ghana for Year of Return activities, visiting to mark 400 years since the start of the transatlantic slave trade. They sit alongside regular customers as Chef Sage and her family serve up plant-based fusion meals. Chef Sage was born in Brooklyn, New York, moved to St. Croix in the U.S. Virgin Islands as a child, and in 2005 relocated to Ghana.
I think when African Americans relocate to Ghana, we do consider this our homeland. We are happy to be here, but that food, you know, the food, you're still looking for what you're accustomed to. So I think I attract the African American crowd because I still have those flavors infused within the food.
Chef Sage does private catering in Accra, as well as her weekly roadside cafe. The menu changes weekly, but can include anything from sweet potato pie to tacos to fusion salads, all made with local ingredients. Customers like Grisel Enduroso say the food is about good taste and community.
You have people from Jamaica, other Caribbean islands, you have people from North America, America itself, but we're from different places. You have people from California, people from the East like myself. And there's something that brings us together as one people. We can all relate to this food.
The links between food in Ghana and the United States are something Issy Bartels, a Ghanaian food entrepreneur, also explores. Her spice mixes and sauces aim to show the similarities in food cultures around the world, especially those with African heritage.
Being able to see where all these hotspots of flavors are and bringing it together, that's what I'm trying to do with SC Spice, and that's what I hope the Year of Return will inspire people to see how connected even food is around the world.
Bartels and Chef Sage say the Year of Return is a good time to reflect on shared history and heritage. Stacey Knott reporting for VOA News Accra.
South Africa's parliament debates the National Health Insurance Bill this month, a plan for universal health care that proponents say will bring justice and equality to the health care system in this deeply unequal country. But critics say the plan is too ambitious, and they doubt the government, which repeatedly has been accused of corruption in other public sector projects, can do it honestly. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
South Africa is one of the most unequal societies in the world. According to the government, only 15% of South Africans have health insurance. The rest falls to the nation's overburdened public health care system. But the government is debating a bill to provide universal coverage, an ambitious plan that they've tested at several public hospitals already. Public hearings begin later this month for the National Health Insurance Bill. Dr. Bandile Masuku, an official in the nation's most populous province, Gauteng, says a national health scheme, in the spirit of Britain's NHS, is a moral necessity.
In a country like South Africa, we are a country, a democracy that has to look after the vulnerable. And the universal health coverage is one way that we're going to do it.
Critics point to the government's track record of corruption and mismanagement and say the plan is too ambitious, too expensive, and too vague. Johan Serfontein is an analyst at the health division of the Free Market Foundation.
We've been at it for 10 years. We don't have enough clarity on how we want to do things now. To think that in the next 7 years, you're suddenly going to miraculously have that clarity, you know, it's just not a realistic proposal.
But for the chronic care patients like 25-year-old Kanyisa Ntombini, anything is better than the current system. She's had numerous surgeries in public hospitals for her ailments, which include blindness. And she says public hospitals need all the help they can get so the country can develop.
As a country, we will never be able to improve because we have this huge number of people who are unproductive and will forever be sick. So we need the NHI to implement it so that we have more funding in rural hospitals and township hospitals so that people's health can improve.
Ntombini says she's willing to subsidize the system.
I think quality health care, like food, like shelter, is something that everybody deserves to have. You know, and for me, I would be more than willing to contribute to ensuring that everybody has a quality health care.
If the bill passes, the system would be implemented by 2026. By then, Ntombini would probably be working as an engineer, earning too much to qualify for public health care. And that, she says, is the point. This plan, she says, is for the next generation of South Africans. Anita Powell, VOA News, Pretoria.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Douglas Impuga in Washington. For all latest developments on the continent, 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our engineer tonight, John Braden, thanks very much for choosing The Voice of America.
This week, put this on your to-do list. Have fun. Listen to Music Time in Africa. Hi there, I'm Heather Maxwell. Join me this Sunday for 55 minutes of sublime, commercial-free Pan-African music. Song of the Week comes out of Nigeria by Zlatan. It's called Bolale. My vintage tune, recorded in the early 1970s, is Karanga storyteller Kalimba player Stephen Gumbo. His baboon story will fascinate and entertain you for sure. Also meet the most famous female voice from Mozambique you've probably never heard of, Mingash. I sat down with her in Maputo for this great interview.
Elisa Dominguez Salatiel-Jamis.
So, to do, listen to Music Time in Africa at 1505 or 20500 Universal Time.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all these skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
can't AU, African Union, can't these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever.
Session. Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa. Stand up!